bothered me anyway.
In 2014, songwriting team Robert and Kristen Anderson Lopez, also husband and wife, swept the award season for their Disney musical, Frozen. Then, in 2015, they were asked by Disney to revisit Frozen for Broadway, which meant that they had to more than double the amount of songs they had originally written. This is The Soundtrack Show. Welcome back to The Soundtrack Show. I'm your host, David W. Collins, and this episode features our very first interview with working soundtrack professionals. I'm honored to present my interview with songwriting team Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. They've achieved so much in their careers, and it seems obvious when talking to them that they're just getting started. Between the two of them, they've won multiple Grammys, Oscars, Emmys, Tonys, Drama Desk Awards, Annie Awards, and more. They've written songs for Winnie the Pooh, Coco, Finding Nemo at the Disney parks, Wonder Pets, even The Simpsons, and of course, Frozen. Robert Lopez even co-wrote the musicals Avenue Q and Book of Mormon, and is the youngest person ever to EGOT, meaning that he is one of only 12 people to have ever won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award. One of the things that really struck me when interviewing them is how focused they are in both their professional and personal lives. They're inspiring to listen to, especially when you consider the creative and personal challenges that any artist has to endure when making the entertainment that we know and love. In this interview, they discuss those challenges, the challenges of having to go back to the well and double the amount of songs that they wrote for Frozen, how to balance family and professional life, their inspirations that they draw from, the art of storytelling through song, and even share some behind-the-scenes stories of bringing Frozen Broadway to life. We go now to our interview with Robert and Kristen Anderson Lopez. You were the first interviews on The Soundtrack Show, so thank you.
Yeah, this is
the first one.
Yeah, I have not made her listen to any shows yet.
Oh, good for you.
Of Soundtrack Show.
And by made her, it just means that the one time we're both in, not in motion, doing a thousand things, is in the car, and we really haven't taken a road trip yet. We listen to you on road trips. Otherwise, we live in Brooklyn. We don't have sound in our travel very much.
right. No, that makes sense. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, or I don't know about earbuds into the city. That seems to be another popular idea.
Yeah, the technology hasn't reached us here yet.
Got it. Oh, good to know.
Yeah, we can't make it happen.
Well,
I mean, that we would listen together. When we're going into the city, you'd be surprised when we go into the city together. We don't listen to earbuds because we get a lot of collaboration done on the train. Every free moment we can be working on one of our many projects, we try to take advantage, especially if the phone isn't ringing.
Oh, that's perfect. Wait, so
when I'm alone, I turn on podcasts.
When he's alone, every time he's alone, he's listening to these podcasts. Like if I'm like, you finish up the dishes, I'll put the kids to sleep. And then he never comes up. Because he's doing the dishes and he's listening to your podcast, and then he finds like a hidden corner somewhere in the house where no one will force him to come up and say goodnight.
Oh, sorry.
But wait, I just want to ask really fast. So you're saying that when you're on the train together,
going into New York, you're working on projects, like, so other people are within earshot of this collaboration going on?
Often, yes. We've had, I'm sure there are people, I wonder sometimes, that we've written, like, done major rewrites of the Broadway show on the subway, where y'all, you know, we'll sit and we'll scribble it and we hand it right over to the stage manager during previews. And I wonder, like, do people wonder why these two grown adults are talking so much about Anna and Elsa? Why they're writing it down so passionately?
That's really funny. There just must be really just huge Disney fanatics to be talking about this, like fan fiction. Only not.
We never find those Disney fanatics. They, the people we bump into are the opposite. They're always like, we even went to the Disney store once and we were checking out and we tried to use our Disneyland card to get a discount. And the person said, what's your employee ID? And they're like, oh, well, we don't have employee ID. Actually, we wrote the songs for Frozen, and Frozen was playing at the time on the stereo, and the person didn't skip a beat and was just like, why?
She rolled her eyes. But of course, it was Christmas time in 2013, and she had heard the Frozen movie soundtrack back to back every minute until or since Thanksgiving. So she was definitely a little steep. She was in an extreme case.
She'd heard Let It Go a few times just in the few weeks it had been open.
I believe she had. Anyway, I'm saying that because there are occasions where we will be on the subway and someone will come up and recognize us and say something to us. Usually if they've heard us talking about Anna and Elsa or I'm wearing like a Frozen raincoat that they gave us.
By the way, congratulations on your recent win for Coco and of course on the songs for Frozen back in 2014. That must be amazing.
Thank you. You know what's funny? I have so much makeup, and this time around, I also clipped fake hair to the back of my head when we won for Coco, that I don't think I look anything like the person who wins those Oscars. In real life, I'm usually wearing ripped jeans and old running shoes and, you know, a sweatshirt with stars on it, like I am today.
I have to be so cautious, and you're so extreme. We're different, you and I, and it's dangerous to dream. It's dangerous.
You know, speaking of Frozen Broadway and working on Frozen Broadway, I wanted to ask you what your process was like going back into Frozen, which you had kind of put away a couple years ago. And then you had to basically open it back up and essentially double the amount of songs. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, we, you know, after Frozen came out, it was very successful, but they said, you know, don't expect us to do a sequel. We don't really do them. So we thought, okay, that's, oh, wait a minute. Sorry. I'm thinking of the sequel.
And I want to talk about that.
My life is one unending loop.
Yes.
One unending Frozen loop.
Sorry, we just got off the phone of talking for 2 hours with the Frozen 2 team. So Bobby's head is in Frozen 2.
I love
Let
it.
Let me take this one, honey. So after Frozen opened, we did Tom Schumacher, who's the head of Disney Theatrical. We sent a text to John Lasseter and said, what are we doing in the Broadway musical? And so Lasseter sent us a text in the middle of the night, and I'm not sure why we were awake to receive it, because we don't usually stay up at like 1 a.m, where it said, we're going to Broadway. And we were very excited. But then very soon after that, it hit us like, oh my God, there's only 7.5 songs in the movie.
Yeah.
That's not enough. A Broadway show at this epic kind of scale is something like Phantom or Les Mis. It's a sung through with big emotions kind of piece. And that has like 23 to 20, 25 songs.
I always wonder if the word score, like a Broadway score, comes from the fact that there's about 20 or so songs in it.
Like full score,
yeah, exactly.
7 years ago.
I always wonder about that.
Deep, man.
So, I mean, and we had just gotten used to writing songs for Disney animated films, which can only have, you know, at the most 9, because they are 85 minutes long at the most. The songs all basically come at the beginning to, you know, maybe 2/3 in. The last act of the Disney animated movie has no songs usually because, you know, adventure and plot take over and you don't want to stop for a song.
Now that's a new rule to break.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But yes. And we call it 7.5 songs because reindeers are better than people is really only a half song.
Right.
And we only got paid half for it.
And now for a brief intermission. We return now to the Soundtrack Show.
So you had to write, how much time did you have to write all the new material before you had to get into rehearsals?
We were in a bit of a bind because we had a show that was opening in La Jolla. That's the summer of 15. And we were also working on Coco and another project. And so we came back from La Jolla after giving everything we had for this show in La Jolla. And we had a meeting with Disney where they sat us down in a room that had this board that had a curtain on it.
It was like an easel with a curtain draped over it.
And they said, okay, we need to talk about the Broadway schedule, and they pulled the curtain, and I looked at it, and I don't know, did my brain sort of exploded, and I started to cry, I think, because they basically were like, now you start, and you have 9 months, you have to have the full draft of this musical by
September, May 1st. So we needed to,
with September, yeah.
To do our final reading of it in May, and that was... It was just not long enough to do all the work we knew it would be and all of our other projects. So what we did was we kind of got ourselves out of a lot of those projects. We sort of cleared the deck and we looked at our own schedule and said, okay, well, here's Christmas Vacation. We can't write songs during that week. So we'll write this song from September 18th through 21st.
We basically magic markered up a big calendar where we put each song slot, because we had an outline, and basically used it like, okay, if we spend 3 days on this song and then 6 days on this song and then 7 days here, and it was this mathematical matrix that took us all the way to May 1st. And if we followed that schedule, we would have a full score by May 1st to go into our first workshop. And whenever we would get behind or whenever we would have, if someone would be sick or something, we'd be like, you can't afford to be sick. Well, this song has to be written. Otherwise, we're stealing from Peter to pay Paul. Adhered to it. We didn't have the happiest life during those times.
It was rough. But on the other hand, we did get to concentrate on one project for a number of months, and that there was a peace to that, a serenity to that in a way of like we're just doing one thing instead of six things.
That is true. And we did we didn't have to travel a lot during that time. That was another really nice thing, is that we were just basically in our basement, because that's where our office was.
And I honestly, here's the part that's really pertinent to you, Dave, because that was the time that I was listening devotedly to your podcast about John Williams and the Star Wars franchise.
This is true, Dave.
This is crazy to me. I just want you to know that's crazy.
Let's slow this down, because I really want you to take it in, because I actually, before you fully admit this, I just want to say Bobby was really not having a good time in September of 15. He really was in a dark place, and he did not know how he was going to bring himself to write this Broadway score. And that's when he found this podcast of yours.
Oh, wow.
And the way you talked about the way John Williams developed themes and created a universe full of different melodies that were related to different characters was something that I had thought about before, but really hadn't, you know, certainly thought as seriously as you were describing it all and laying it all out. And I realized that we were in the position to sort of do that too with Frozen as a franchise, because we were, you know, not only did we have to do this Broadway show, but the sequel afterwards. And I realized that, you know, a big chunk of my 40s is going to be working on these movies. And I get to, if I look at us as like a married couple version of John Williams writing a musical, creating a musical universe of themes we've already developed and expanding those themes and trying to do what John Williams did for our franchise, then it would be almost like living out a fantasy from my youth.
He really turned a corner with that gestalt shift. And then we really hit all of our dates.
I got super inspired, to make a long story short.
That is, it's just unbelievable to me. And it's so humbling and so crazy. And I still can't believe it. And I also want to say that I obviously haven't seen the show yet, but I spent the weekend listening to the soundtrack album after it came out, and it's so successful. You guys have succeeded with Flying Colors. I can't wait to see the show, and I cannot believe that you were listening to me podcast over here while that was going on. I just am just so touched by that.
I went back to the first episode and just listened to them all.
Wow.
That's Bobby great. Does have a little bit of an obsessive compulsive listener side to him, where like it's basically your podcast and then the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
I do like that one too.
I can see that he uses them to just keep his creativity fresh and creative outside what can sometimes be a very claustrophobic life occasionally when you work with your spouse, then you go home with your spouse to take care of the children you've created with your spouse in the house that you've built with your spouse. I go to book club. I see moms. I have friends. Bobby has podcasts.
Well, that's amazing. I want to go back to something you said about the timeline for writing these songs, because I think that people imagine from the outside looking in that when you're at this level where you're doing Broadway shows and you're doing movies and movie musicals, that time is a luxury that you would have, that at this level you have all the resources in the world. But usually, from what I hear from people and in my own experience, the opposite can be true. Would you agree with that, or what's your take on that in terms of the pressure that you experience when creating these?
One of the first and weirdest things that you discover is that when you get to the next level, your hours are taken up sometimes more often by people asking you to come talk or do this gala or that gala or interviews, for instance. In the middle of our day, that the hours just disappear. And then if you have children, finding those hours for work time can be the hardest. So finding a way to farm everything else out that you possibly can.
Yeah, and we also, we realized early on in our collaboration that every hour that we worked, we were paying someone at least $20 to babysit. So right. that created a money pressure and a time pressure to use that time well. And then on top of that, it gave our day kind of a 9 to 5, almost, I guess, 10 to 6 form. And so we're creative. When you're creative at a certain time every day, I think it tends to help you be creative when you need to be, as opposed to waiting for inspiration to strike or feeling blocked, anything like that. I think once you get into the routine of creating every day on a schedule, those problems tend to slip away because you can rely on yourself you can rely on your creativity to be there when you need it to be.
You know, there also is a mantra that we try to remind ourselves, which is The truth is, when we were dating, what we would do for fun is like sit around the piano and sing songs. And even on our honeymoon, we were like creating a little video movie with our camera, like writing our own little weird movie. What we do for fun is we're creative together. So we also really try to remind ourselves when the pressure gets bad that we would be doing this anyway. We would be doing it for free. Especially when you choose projects that you love, that are close, that have something that only we could say, that is tapped into our own personal struggles and discoveries, that it's fun. We sometimes have to remind ourselves, like, this is fun. We would write this anyway, so let's just do it.
That's great. And when you are in the middle of writing and you're searching for inspiration, do you have sort of the go-to classics that you go to, the stuff that you loved growing up? If you had to name any of those, I mean, do those constantly come back to you? Or are you listening to music while you're writing, or is it more silent and you just kind of almost bring it out of each other?
Well, first of all, before the music comes the story usually, and we work, unlike a film composer who comes in when the story is more or less locked, we come in when the story is at a very early stage of development, sometimes before there is any story, and so we talk and talk a lot, whether it's just, you know, me and Kristen, or me and Kristen and one other collaborator, or me and Kristen and Disney, and just talk a lot about the characters, the story, the arcs, each moment, and what moments could give rise to a song. And so for every song, there's tons and tons of talking that happens before you start to even talk about any music. And then, yes, we definitely play songs that are models, songs that inspire us. I don't know, like, for example,
that's part of the fun, yeah. Is you know, when we knew that we had, like, the Let It Go moment is sort of the classic moment where we knew there was going to be a transformation, and we had written this outline when we basically collapsed the movie and changed the main characters completely. We then looked at this outline where Elsa was going to be this sort of perfect buttoned up person with a secret to hide, and then the secret was going to come out and she was going to transform. At the time, she was transforming into a villain, and we wrote on the outline, Elsa's badass song goes here. And coming home and going, okay, what are examples of badass songs? Of the opposite of the someday my prince will come kind of song, but more of a how do I tap into my own power kind of song. So we listen to everything. We listen to Adele, we listen to Alanis Morissette, we listen to Avril Lavigne, we listen to Tori Amos, I'm a huge Sarah Bareilles fan, and that was basically the only album, Little Voice was like the only album I had ever listened to on Spotify, because I'm not great with technology, so I knew how to get that one thing on my phone, and that's what we listened to, and then we...
And then you forget all that stuff, then you have put to it forget. Out of your mind, yeah. And then you... We've talked so much, Kristen. I remember when she, you know, came up with the phrase "Let It Go." She said, "I think this could be the title," and I remember saying, like, "Yeah, maybe, but let's put that away for the moment." And then once we got to writing the song, it seemed pretty clear that that should be the title, because "Let It Go" not only means let the past go, forget all that stuff. But it also means let my powers go, let my powers out. So it worked in two different ways that both were kind of really apropos for the moment. And so we, you know, we had all this material living in us, and then it was a matter of, like, letting it come out and arranging it in the right order and building it so that it felt right. And then figuring out the melody, you know, is the melody, does it go up here and down there, or down there and up here?
Yep, and in our own collaboration, and I think it is tied to what we did for fun when we were dating, is we'll talk and we'll talk and we'll get a bunch of phrases and on notebooks and in computers, and Bobby might, you know, play at the piano and have a couple different things. And then at some point, there's always a moment where it's like improv time, where he'll either go to the piano and all improv, or there's always a moment where you just have to take the leap and start singing some of this stuff on top of some of the grooves that he's found, or just make some choices and see where those choices lead. And so it is a little bit like improvising or pretending together. And then you take the things that you're like, ooh, that was fun, that was good, and you just keep putting those pieces together until you have something that's polished that you can then further refine.
That was in the film, and then it seems like you really doubled or tripled down on this transformation in the Broadway show, because now Elsa has three songs about this transformation, including that wonderful sort of self, you know, identity song about being a monster. Am I a monster? Was that something that you knew you wanted to go into, or was it kind of a surprising discovery along the way when you were figuring out where to add what to the musical?
We knew it was partially dictated by structure, because a musical on stage has two acts separated by an intermission. And so if we had just followed what was in the movie score, act two, Elsa would really only sing one half of a duet, and that would be it. So we knew we needed to write something big for her in act two, and that's how Monster came about. And it was a surprise. I mean, we knew it needed, a lot of it was dictated by the story.
One of the great things about being able to go back and do this musical and expand it and go deeper with it is that when we were first writing the musical, the movie, the story was constantly changing. So it was like throwing darts at a moving target with these songs. And so many songs fell on the floor because of story choices. And one of the things that was great about this is that we learned that the story resonated. It had the kind of response that we knew, okay, the story's working. Now we just deepen it. And we looked at this moment in what we called act three of the movie, where you just see Elsa, it's actually two moments in the movie where she's sort of like pacing and she's wearing those high heels on the ice and everything's sort of turning red. And then there's another moment, and we called them sort of check backs with Elsa, just to keep Elsa's storyline alive in the movie, that like, oh yeah, Elsa's up there, what's going on? But there were always things that we knew were going through her mind that never had gotten executed exactly right. Like, why did she make the decision to not hurt those men? What was she thinking up there? What were her choices? What's going on in her head? We only get those through close-up, those sort of awareness of something's going on with her. And this was this great chance to take those close-ups and define them for ourselves and for the Frozen fans. So that really dictated our choices with Monster, I think.
Right, because close-ups are lost in live theater. It's a totally different...
Yeah, just ask anybody in the back.
Yeah.
It's finally come to knock down my door. I can't hide this time like I hid before. The storm is awake, the danger is real. My time's running out. Don't feel. Fear will be your enemy, and death its consequence. That's what they once said to me, and it's starting to make sense. All this pain, all this fear began because of me. Is the thing they see the thing I have to be? A monster, were they right? Has the dark in me finally come to light? Am I a monster, full of rage? Nowhere to go but on a rampage? Or am I just a monster in a cage?
Winter, bring back summer.
That's so interesting. And one of the things I thought was so interesting, too, was when you were developing exposition for the Broadway show, I was really struck by "Let the sun shine on." I believe that's the line.
And, that's
and,
right.
And how it yeah. deepens. I mean, it totally deepens and pays off that line, "Let the storm," I think it's "the storm rage on" in "Let It Go." Yeah. Suddenly that line became so empowering. Not that it wasn't before, but it had so much more meaning of in terms of like defying the mantra of her, you know, royal responsibility and familial responsibility. And was that something that you knew you wanted to do, or did it just kind of come out as you were writing? How did you come up with that moment? Because it was brilliant.
Should we tell them the dirty secret of that one?
Yeah.
Is that we wrote that version in tech for Broadway. That was
wow.
the last thing. That was the last thing that we wrote.
Yes. The opening is always the hardest, and it's always the thing you finish last. We knew we needed a big opening that would introduce the chorus, and because there is no chorus in the movie. There's no ensemble. In a movie, the biggest thing you could do is a huge explosion or a big close-up or some plot thing. But the biggest thing you can do on stage is to have everybody stand front and sing. So we wanted to introduce our ensemble in the opening and have them be singing about the girls. So we wrote a song called "Anna and Elsa." That was what
it was like. Anna and Elsa, side by side, the light in the dark months, the kingdom's pride, the promise of our future shine. I didn't want to hit that. That was basically our temp score for that moment.
Yeah.
And that's what we opened with in Denver. But then when we came back in the fall after Denver, we changed the ending because the Denver tryout used "Love Is an Open Door" as the end finale and the resolution. But that didn't feel right for a lot of reasons. So when we came back, we reordered the ending and we took the version of "Let It Go" that you'll hear on the score.
And got that into it. And we had to rewrite the lyrics of "Let It Go" to use it as a finale, because it's about being together, not about being alone. And therefore, and the storm is over. So we changed that line to "Let the sun shine on."
Let the sun shine on into the bridge.
Right.
And that's where then we realized, that will be so much more meaningful way at the end if at the beginning, basically the beginning song, "Let the sun shine on," is the "I want" song for the people of Arendelle. They want to be safe, they want to be happy, and their safety and happiness and unity depends on the unity of the sisters.
And the family.
And we were also thinking a little bit about our country, actually. Yeah. How important it is to have leaders who are talking and communicating well. And how the people who are led by these leaders.
Don't bring your politics onto this podcast.
It's not politics. It's just saying, like, when you've got a family in conflict at the head, it means that you've got a storm brewing.
Oh,
Do you think there is more scrutiny or less scrutiny working on a film versus working on a Broadway musical? Like, if you're working on a Disney film, which has such a strong musical legacy, is that harder, or is are the numbers, just the sheer numbers of songs working on a Broadway musical, does that make it more difficult? Or are they just are they just apples and oranges?
Well, yeah, what scrutiny by whom? Because there's scrutiny, there's always scrutiny. Yeah. and we try not to think about the scrutiny, because that's a definitely a toxic, wasteland you can get stuck in. It's like, how do I please everyone in the world? Or how do I please the theater community? It's very hard. Mm. The best answer to that is please the story you know needs to be out there in the world to do the best good.
Please yourself.
Please yourself.
Your friends. Yeah, please your community. And don't worry about the world at large, because it will always have some opinion, and some of the opinions will not be good.
Yes.
Just be true to your own creative voice, essentially.
Yeah.
Creative voice. And for me, I just keep going back to my gut, that the songs that have resonated the best and that have really done some good out in the world tend to come from a place that's very personal and very charged in ourselves, you know, that is something that, like, this whole idea of let it go, about trying not to be so perfect and live up to expectations that are outside of yourself, comes from very personal place in both of us, I think. And so I try to tap into those places whenever possible. And then, of course, there's the writing of, like, the In Summers and stuff, which is a very different part of us, which is more like the snarky kids at the back of the bus trying to write something subversive.
The Soundtrack Show will continue after these messages. Welcome back to The Soundtrack Show.
I know at one point you mentioned the Sherman Brothers in reference to that song when you did an interview. Do you have any other songs that have clear inspirations like that one? Well, you mentioned the Sherman Brothers, and I think you also mentioned Alan Menken's Part of Your World. Oh, well, that was a different interview, I think. But do you have any clear, direct inspiration?
In Summer, I mean, for example, within Summer, I think we wanted it to feel old-fashioned, because we wanted him to have a charm and an old-fashioned kind of gentleness to him, because that character could have easily tilted into the annoying. If his song had too much energy, it would have been, you know, it would have gone into that obnoxious
place. And we could give
place.
You and we did write a song called Hot, Hot Ice that was more of a soca beat kind of thing. And we were like, oh, God, let this snowman die.
So we thought in terms of a soft shoe. So I think we probably thought about If I Only Had a Brain.
Yes, that's The Wizard of Oz is clearly in there. Except the difference is, it would be like if the Scarecrow were saying, If I Only Had a Match.
There's some sort of self-destroying impulse in the character, which we thought was funny.
Oh, the sky will be blue, and you guys will be there too, when I finally do what frozen things do in summer.
I'm gonna tell him.
Don't you dare.
We'll be back for part two of this interview very soon. Thank you.